It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. At age 45, when Elizabeth Heineman, Lisa, two her friends, and her partner Glenn decided to try and have a baby, they knew the odds were long. But they got pregnant, and a blissfully easy pregnancy followed. For 9 months, Lisa felt her healthy son grow inside her. But at the last moment, something went horribly wrong. She's written about the experience of losing a child to stillbirth in her new memoir, Ghost Belly, and she is here with me today. Hello, Lisa.
Hi, Charity. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And take us to that time in your life. You were 45 years old. You had been in a long-term relationship before. You had a son from your previous relationship who was 16 at this
point. Right, right.
And you and your partner, Glenn, decide to try to have a baby. Now, a lot of people at age 45 wouldn't even consider that.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, with my previous relationship, my then partner Julia and I had a child. We're very, very happy parents. I'd always wanted to have another one, but for various reasons having to do with professional complications, it wasn't possible to have a second child. Julia and I broke up, and I became involved with Glenn, who himself had never been a father but always wanted children. And we just decided to give it a try. You never know.
And all indications were pretty good for you, although, again, both of you were not at the normal age
right,
for procreation, yeah. And you needed a little extra help.
We'd have a little bit of extra help. Had a sort of a minimal dose of Clomid for me, and we used intrauterine insemination. But frankly, you know, given our age, we were pretty fertile, and I conceived fairly easily.
And then the pregnancy for you went incredibly well.
Yes. My first pregnancy was very, very easy. Some people just have easy pregnancies, and I'm one of those lucky people. I also, you know, I'm fit for my age. I'm kind of lucky that way. So at 45, I felt more like 35. And my body handled it very well. I had a very easy pregnancy.
And, of course, Glenn was very excited about becoming a father. And the two of you were so looking forward to this baby.
We sure were.
The pregnancy went to term, went beyond term, mm-hmm. and all the signs were that this baby inside you, this baby that you called Thor.
That's right.
And tell me why you called him Thor.
Well, we needed, you know, what we called our silly fetal name. We didn't want to learn the sex of the baby. We wanted to have a surprise upon the birth. So basically, I asked my older son, Adam, what do you want to call it in the meantime? And he came up with a sort of a crazy, you know, Thor level 70 dark mage. So we called it Thor for short.
And that just stuck.
It just kind of stuck, yeah.
And so you were carrying this baby who you'd gotten to know inside you. And again, everything looked good. You went into labor and then things went wrong, but you didn't know that at first.
That's right. You know, my first pregnancy with Adam, I also went a bit post-date. Some women gestate longer than others. So I went into labor, mild contractions, you know, there's spaced a certain distance apart. And then at some point, some bleeding started. And it turned out, you know, from the doctor's reports afterwards, probably what had happened is that I'd had a sudden placental abruption.
And what is that?
That means the placenta basically separates from the uterine wall. Some cases that can happen during the pregnancy rather than in labor. Sometimes the placenta separates partially from the uterine wall. But what happened in my case, in all likelihood, is that during labor, it separated fully from the uterine wall. And what that means is the baby stops getting oxygen.
When did you know that something was going wrong?
Well, when there was some bleeding. It was clear that there was something wrong. And once the baby stops getting oxygen, there's not a lot of time. Things moved very quickly at that juncture.
And, of course, everyone around you went into emergency mode. You delivered the baby as quickly
That's
as
right,
you could.
Within a couple more contractions.
When efforts started immediately to resuscitate
That's
him,
right.
But
That's
it
right.
didn't work. When did you find yeah. out that it didn't work?
Well, it was pretty clear to me when the baby was born and resuscitation efforts started. It was clear to me the baby wasn't breathing. There was a reason this was happening. It was clear that, you know, the talk around was, let's get resuscitation moving. And basically nobody said anything to me, but I knew that if the baby had been resuscitated, somebody would have said something to me. So when I wasn't hearing anything, I knew that the news could only be bad.
The idea of having a stillborn baby is so difficult to imagine for most mothers, for most fathers, the idea of going through that experience. And it's something that we don't get prepared for. I mean, had anyone spoken to you about the possibility when you were pregnant, either time, that the possibility that the baby would be stillborn?
No, no one had. And of course, people don't like to talk about things like that when at all. Certainly not. They don't want to talk about things like that to pregnant women. Who wants to share horror stories with pregnant women? But I had an interesting discussion afterwards with the doula who had led my birth preparation class, who was very, very kind and very caring afterwards. And we talked about this lack of preparation. She said, you know, once upon a time in my classes, we did devote a portion of one class to miscarriage and stillbirth. And at some point, we stopped talking about that. I'm not quite sure why that was. But it never seemed necessary. And now all of a sudden, I realize it is necessary.
For mothers who give birth, the culmination of that process is, of course, the first moment when they get to hold their child. And you write about the moment when you got to hold your baby, Thor.
Yeah,
and I would like for you to read that for us.
Thanks. Well, what happened is, you know, I was in the hospital at this point, and the medical staff basically came and said, you know, would you like to see him? And I said, of course. So they brought him to me, and I'll read that section here. When they bring Thor to me, I feel all the tension of the last hours slip out of the room like a sigh. Finally, we've arrived at our destination. This is our destination. I can hold Thor in my arms. This is what I've been waiting for 9 months. This is what's been imminent since I went into labor a few hours earlier. This moment was delayed because all sorts of other things have gotten in the way. The AMT people taking Thor downstairs to the kitchen, the ambulance ride, the light blue hordes palpating my belly, Glenn going to see Thor separately, my having to argue with the man from the medical examiner's office. But finally, the moment has arrived. I can have Thor. There is something terribly elemental about that moment, about looking forward to it in the few minutes between my conversation with the boss from the medical examiner's office and the time they bring Thor. Something so elemental that even death doesn't get in the way. Thor was inside me, and now he is rightfully outside. He is outside, but he belongs in my arms, cradled naked against my breast, just a rib cage away from where he's been curled up all those months. Once upon a time, stillborn babies were whisked away and the parents didn't even see them. But now hospitals have changed their practice and parents can have and hold their stillborn babies to say goodbye. No one seems to have thought of the fact that first the parents have to say hello. Perhaps that's why they think half an hour is enough. But we have 6 hours. Thor will not change during those 6 hours. He will not be freshly born when I get him, then 6 hours old when I give him back. He will not be awake, then asleep. He will not first be unwashed, then washed, first hungry, then sated, first crying, then content, then crying again. He will be exactly the same at the end of the 6 hours as he was at the beginning, just a little cooler, a little stiffer, but we aren't thinking about that. And so the 6 hours will be a moment, not an expanse of time. But it will be a moment that will stretch out like silly putty that resists snapping as you stretch it farther and farther. And even though you know it won't stretch forever, for the moment, what's amazing is that it stretches as far as it does. This is what I want to do in those 6 hours. To take that moment in which Thor will not grow 6 hours older and inhabit it fully. To fully absorb Thor, because this will be our only chance. And because this is so important, other things can wait. Like crying, like thinking about Thor's absence. I will have a lifetime to explore Thor's absence, every inch of it, to acquaint all my senses with it, to inhabit it. Any time we spend crying now, bewailing his death, will be time lost to things like singing to him, touching him, things we have only a few hours to do. Thor's absence will not last just a moment, not even a stretched-out moment. It will occupy time. First, he will be dead a day, then a week, then a month, then a year. I will have the rest of my life to explore it, and its exploration will require the rest of my life. But the time to explore Thor's absence is not now. Now is the time to absorb Thor's presence.
Elizabeth Heineman reading from her memoir, Ghost Belly. And Lisa, you mention in that passage that you had Thor for 6 hours, and instinctively you knew that you needed this time with him. But how did you get those 6 hours? Because you were only offered a half an hour.
That's right. You know, it's standard practice now for most hospitals to offer you time with your baby. And the medical examiner came and said to you, do you want your baby? It was 4 a.m. And I said, of course I want to see him. And they said, you can have him for half an hour. I wanted my older son, Adam, and my ex, Julia, to be able to come over and see Thor if they wanted to. But it was 4 a.m. I didn't want to phone, wake up my 16-year-old son and say, please come if you'd like to and see your dead half-brother. So I asked the medical examiner, you know, can we have longer? Can we wait so my son and my ex can come see him? And he initially said no. And I had to argue with him a little bit. I said, well, why not? And he said, well, that's kind of how we do it. And I said, well, when are they going to actually do the autopsy? There was going to have to be an autopsy. And he said, well, probably not till 10. So there was a little bit back and forth. And finally, they did relent. And I appreciated their flexibility. But I also have to say I appreciated the fact that earlier on I hadn't accepted the offer of morphine to relieve my pain, because I needed to have my wits about me to be able to spend time with Thor, because that was what I needed to do.
When you were holding the baby, you write that you felt happy.
I did. Yeah. Yeah. You know, the new reality was that I was the mother of a dead baby. That was the new reality. And to be able to be with him felt good. I needed, you know, the alternative was not to have him at all, to have carried this baby, to have delivered him, and then simply to have a void, a complete absence. So to be able to see him and hold him and sing to him, that's what counted as happiness at that moment.
I'm talking with Elizabeth Heineman. She is the author of a memoir called Ghost Belly, where she recounts the experience of losing her son, Thor, to stillbirth. We'll talk more in a moment. Later in the hour, I'll talk with Kate Safras, who is one of the founding members of the group Healthy Birthday, founded by 5 Des Moines moms who all lost babies to stillbirth or infant death. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Right now I'm talking with Elizabeth Heineman. She is the author of a new memoir called Ghost Belly, where she tells the story of losing her son, Thor, to stillbirth. And the pregnancy went very well. She was 45, 46 years old when Thor was born. It was a later in life pregnancy, but the pregnancy went very well. And just at the last moment, things went wrong. And Lisa, before the break, we were talking about the moment when you got to hold Thor for the first time and your baby was dead, but just having your baby with you gave you this sense of peace and this sense of happiness. And you, of course, had to let him go because an autopsy had to be done. And he's dead. You can't keep him with you. But you did find that you didn't have to let him go as quickly as you thought you would. And that message came from kind of a surprising place. That was from the funeral director that you chose. Tell me about your first interaction with the funeral director and how you learned that you could have more time with your baby.
Yeah. Well, you know, the morning after the stillbirth, we woke up at home and we had an appointment with the funeral director. And we went in and we, you know, Glenn and I, of course, hadn't at all thought about burials or what to do. So we went and saw the funeral director, this wonderfully compassionate man with a terrific sense of humor named Mike. And, you know, we were talking about, oh, what do we want to do? How do we want to have the service? When do we want it? How do we get our family to come in? Because our family lives far away. And it was very clear that we just weren't ready to make decisions. Mike let us know that, according to Iowa law, if you don't bury or cremate in 3 days, you are required to embalm the body. But there were reasons for waiting with the burial, namely that it was in a week Thanksgiving was going to be coming and it would be very easy for our families to travel. So in a sense, in order to buy some time, we decided to do that and to delay the service and burial until our families could come. And then just as we were about to leave, Mike said, well, you just come and visit him anytime. And I said, what? And he said, well, just come and visit him. You can see him anytime you want. And I said, really? I had no idea you could do that. And then he went on and said, shoot, you can take him home. And, oh, I was flabbergasted. And I have realized, of course, in hindsight, that if Glenn and I had given any thought to this ahead of time, or frankly, to preparing for our own deaths, which we also hadn't done, we probably would have been very interested in what's sometimes called the home funeral movement or the green funeral movement or the natural funeral movement, which, among other things, can involve caring for the body yourself rather than having it, in a sense, kind of outsourced to the morticians in the funeral home. What we ended up doing was kind of a hybrid. Obviously, there was professional involvement. He was at a funeral home. But we found that we were able to go in and visit with Thor. I would hold him and read to him and sip my tea. And we took him home a couple of times. To us, that was enormously important and very, very satisfying. Our home was supposed to be Thor's home. And it felt very important for us, now that we had the opportunity, to be able to have Thor inhabit that home, to be able to, in a sense, show him the room where he would have lived, to be able to feel his presence in the home.
To some people, I'm sure, this sounds very strange, the idea of bringing home a dead baby.
Yes.
And creating experiences with that baby.
Yeah.
To you, it became a very natural thing. But did you question it? Did you think, maybe this is a little weird?
You know, at the time, I didn't. But at the time, I was also very aware that many other people would. I was also aware that if somebody had asked me 2 weeks earlier, I probably would have said, well, non-judgmentally, if that's what you want to do, you should do. But I frankly would not want to do that. And it was really only the experience of having a dead child that made me realize that, of course, I wanted to be with this child's body.
The fact that the funeral director suggested it makes me think that it must not be that uncommon.
Indeed, that's right. Yeah.
Was this – do you know? Have you talked to him about it? Is this an experience that a lot of people
want to have? I think about this in a few different ways. One thing that I've learned is that when I talk to other parents who have lost small children or infants, they don't miss a beat. They say, of course you wanted to be with the baby. I did too. And many of them, in fact, did spend time with the body. I also happen to be a historian, so I'm very much aware of the fact that until fairly recently, even in Western industrialized societies, people took care of their loved ones at home. And many of us have seen old movies, right, where the body is lying in state in the living room and friends and family come by and they stroke the cheek and they hold the hand and they tell it a little story and give it a kiss. So this business of intimacy with a dead body of someone you loved is not really extraordinary. It's very extraordinary in our time and place in our culture. I've also had the experience of giving readings and having people in the audience raise their hands and say, well, I come from Ghana or I come from Mexico. And of course, we all always have the body in our home and people come by and spend time with it. So in a larger perspective, it's not that uncommon. But indeed, when we think about it in our time and place, many people's initial reaction is to think it's very, very strange.
How did your partner feel about it?
He also, of course, he was grief-stricken in his own way and, in a sense, like me, didn't know what comes next. What do we do? In a way, I knew right away, if we have the opportunity to spend time with Thor, that's what I want to do. He was perhaps not quite as clear, but since I seemed to know, the one thing he could tell is that it did me good to be able to spend time with Thor. And at the very least, he knew that he wanted what was best for me. He also, of course, would come to visit Thor in the funeral home. And then when we took him home, Glenn also carried Thor, spent time with him. So it was an important part of his experience as well.
You also almost immediately started writing.
Yes.
About your experience. And that clearly has been incredibly therapeutic for you.
Yeah.
To
mm-hmm.
put this experience down on paper. You had never kept a journal before in your life. So what prompted this writing? How did that start?
You know, it was I have no idea where it came from, to be honest. That first morning we were home, or I should say, yeah, we came home, we went to bed. I woke up in the morning and I just grabbed a pencil and paper and started scribbling. And in the next days, I just kept at it. It wasn't a conscious decision, gee, I need to write down this experience. It was just something I needed to do. So I did it. And over time, it became clear to me that, of course, we eventually did have to bury Thor, but in a way, continuing to write was a way of keeping him with me and keeping that experience with me and continuing to explore it. It became – I was supposed to be taking care of an infant, but there was no infant to take care of. This was a way of being with him and working through my experience.
I'm talking with Elizabeth Heinemann. She's the author of the new memoir, Ghost Belly, about her experience of losing her baby, Thor, to stillbirth. And Lisa, did you know anyone else who had had this experience?
I didn't know that I knew anyone else, but it turned out I did. I learned all kinds of things. We don't talk about stillbirth much in our culture, but in fact, it's much more common than we think. Statistics are collected inconsistently from state to state, but a common estimate is 1 in 115 pregnancies ends in stillbirth, which is quite a lot when you think about it. What happened is once my experience became known around the community, all kinds of people came to me and said, my mother had a stillbirth and I never really understood it, or my sister-in-law. I became the repository of all kinds of stories that people had been keeping quiet. Then I learned about I happened to be doing some research on my own family history, and I learned that my great-grandmother, I always thought she had 6 children. It turned out that she'd had 9, and 3 had died in infancy. So it turned out there were all these stories out there about stillbirth and people, losing infants shortly after death that have become invisible to us.
Did that help you to learn those stories?
Well, it let me know that there was a kind of a community out there. And certainly, of course, that community is very important. It also let me know that there was something really important about communicating this experience, about, since I did happen to be writing anyway, and I – although I'm not an experienced in sort of literary writing, I'm an academic, so I've written scholarly books. I really wrote the book for my own purposes, but it became very important to me to know that I was communicating something.
There was the sadness, there was the grief, there was the loneliness, and months of daily tears and dealing with this emptiness in your life. But I think every parent who has ever lost a child also goes through a period of questioning, wondering if somehow this was their own fault. And you had an unusual situation in that you were a 46-year-old woman who'd had a very healthy pregnancy, and you chose to give birth with a midwife in your home. And I'm sure that there are people who hear that and immediately think, oh, that's why the baby died. And you yourself, that was one of your first questions. Did the baby die because I was at home? How did you go about trying to answer that very difficult question?
Yeah, it's true. When people hear my story, they tend to have one of two responses. One is, it was the fault of the home birth. If she'd been in a hospital, it wouldn't have happened. And of course, you can't really say that without knowing a little bit more medical detail than that, right? You need to actually know what it was that happened. Is this something that could have gone differently in the hospital? Another very common response, I think it's a response that comes out of kindness and wanting to save me from torturing myself, is to say to me, you never can know. Sometimes these things just happen. But as you say, when you're a parent and your child has died, you need to know whether there's something you could have done differently. It's not satisfying to just kind of brush that off and say you'll never know. I really did need to explore this question of whether I had made a terribly wrong decision. And that involved a lot of exploration of the medical details of what exactly had happened. It meant exploring various decisions that were made along the way. There's the decision for the home birth, but even once you've made that decision, just as if you're having a hospital, if you're planning a hospital birth, along the course of the pregnancy, decisions get made. when you're in a hospital setting as well. During the course of delivery, decisions get made, whether you're in a hospital setting or in a home birth setting. I was a low-risk pregnancy. This is a planned home birth with a certified nurse midwife. So that's kind of the, you know, the sort of gold standard
right.
for
and,
home
and
birth.
And there is controversy in Iowa over home births. Giving birth at home with a certified nurse midwife is legal.
Yes,
and
that's right.
It's an option that people can choose if they can find one.
Right, right, yeah. And of course, it's only suitable for low risk pregnancies. But like I say, you know, there's obviously home birth is something that I think can be safe. This is why I chose it. My first child, also Adam, was born in an out of hospital setting with trained midwives, nurse midwives. That happened to be in Berlin, in Germany, in an environment where that's less polarized around the issue of home birth. And that meant that midwives who practice out of hospital were, in a sense, more mainstreamed into the medical profession. That created a different environment, both for having a home birth and also probably a different environment for how you interpret it when things go wrong.
So you had to ask yourself this question, and you were 12 days overdue. You and your midwife had been following the pregnancy very closely. You'd been doing a non-stress test every other day with the baby, and he had seemed to be fine.
That's right.
Your midwife had said, if you go much longer, we need to schedule an ultrasound. So that was the first big question for you. Had we done an ultrasound, would we have seen that there was a problem?
Right. And of course, a lot of attention focused on this. Should she have ordered an ultrasound earlier? We don't know for sure. Of course, there was no ultrasound. However, given that the placental abruption almost certainly happened during labor, an ultrasound probably, in fact, wouldn't have shown anything.
You also had to think about the question of if you had given birth in the hospital setting, even with midwives. Hospitals are very nervous about letting people go very far past their due
right.
date. So
mm-hmm.
would you have been induced?
That was another question, right? If I'd been receiving hospital care, the hospital staff might have been much quicker to say, listen, we've gone, let's say, 7 days post-date. It's time to induce. That indeed might have made a difference. Right.
If so, you had gone along with it.
If I'd gone along with it, which I might or might not have. Of course, they can't order an induction. They can recommend it. Me, you know, I'd been having these non-stress tests. We knew the baby was doing fine. I might have asked some questions about whether it was really necessary to induce, according to a schedule, or should we just look at how the baby's doing?
So with all of these questions, and there can't be a definitive answer, how do you think about these questions in your mind today? How have you resolved it?
Yeah. Well, in my case, there are so many unknowns. I think that one thing we also often think about was, gee, if you have an emergency situation and you're in the hospital, they can jump in with a C-section very quickly, which is true. It appears in my case, though, that the placental abruption happened rather early in labor. And even if you're planning a hospital birth, the second you go to labor, you don't rush to the hospital right away. Right. So there's, again, another sort of common assumption that, gee, if you're planning a hospital birth, of course, you would actually be in the hospital. That in my case, probably wouldn't have been true. It sort of goes to show that once you get actually into the medical details, it turns out to be a little more complicated than home birth versus hospital birth. In my case, we had to conclude, and the midwife herself concluded, if you'd been receiving hospital care, they would have pushed for an induction, and then Thor probably would have lived. And that indeed is the reality that I live with. It's not the reality for all cases of home birth. I think my midwife is a very responsible practitioner. She's been practicing for over 2 decades with no bad outcomes. Any medical practitioner will tell you that at some point in their career, they make a judgment call that turns out to be the wrong judgment call. And in this case, deciding not to sort of move towards induction earlier turned out to be the wrong judgment call.
What have you gained from telling your story?
What have I gained by telling my story? You know, it's funny because when I was writing, part of the process of writing was about just needing to process. But I also very much felt a need to communicate because there is so much silence surrounding stillbirth. And even my dearest friends and even my family, people who are enormously sympathetic, I realized there were things we weren't really able to talk about, questions they didn't feel comfortable asking, things that they needed to learn about in a private room where they didn't have to worry about whether their face revealed that they were thinking – they were having questions about what I was saying, that in some senses in order to be able to communicate, I needed to allow people space to do that in environments other than a face-to-face discussion. But I very much needed to communicate. I needed to communicate what that kind of intense grief felt like, not just in the following weeks but in months and even a year afterward. So that's what I felt that I really gained by going through this process of writing about it.
Lisa, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me on your show.
Elizabeth Heineman is the author of the memoir Ghost Belly. She writes about her pregnancy and losing her baby, Thor. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.